210. Welcome to CBS Mornings on the Go. Ahead on this Friday, June 26th, news you can use to save money. Kelly O'Grady has tips for homeowners who are feeling overwhelmed by higher prices. There are ways to cut costs on remodeling projects, and she'll show us how. Plus, first on CBS Mornings, Jalen Brunson's mom, Sandra Brunson, spoke to our Dr. John LaPook about healthy ways to encourage your kids to excel and how to raise a champion. And Nate's got a great assignment today. He's in Los Angeles for this weekend's BET Awards, a.k.a. Culture's Biggest Night. He hung out with this year's host, actor and comedian Drewski, and got a preview of what to expect on the show. Let's just say Nate and Drewski had a great time together. All that and more ahead.
It is a great hour, and we begin it with the latest on the dangerous weather across the country, including massive wildfires in Utah. They're expected to be the most destructive in the state's history, and there's still no end in sight there. Meanwhile, parts of Texas and Oklahoma are cleaning up after getting slammed with powerful winds overnight. Rob Marciano is in Baltimore with more. Hey, Rob, good morning. Wow, you're on a boat.
Yeah.
Looks like a tall sailing ship.
Matt, check this out. Yeah, it is big. This is massive. This is the U.S. Coast Guard Cutter Eagle. It is a huge 295-foot, nearly 100-year-old tall ship and training vessel that they use for the Coast Guard. But more importantly, this year, it's among 20 nations and dozens of tall ships that are going to be celebrating our nation's 250th birthday, of course, culminating in New York Harbor. But this is the tour that it's been on and the stops it's going to be taking. It started in New Orleans, and now obviously we rode this thing into Baltimore from Annapolis yesterday. It gets into New York Harbor on July 4th weekend. Organizers say it will be the largest maritime and aerial gathering in American history. And check this out. Yesterday, we got to see why they call this training vessel a tall ship. The masts on this thing are on the height of a 15-story building. And yeah, pucker factor's real there. The Eagle's captain, Captain Chris Ensley, what a gentleman. He told us about the response from onlookers witnessing these tall ships coming into port.
Every port we pull into, we're bringing on 8,000-10,000 tourists in a three-day period. And it's awesome to get to tell them the story of what the Coast Guard is, what the Eagle is, who these cadets are, and frankly, to tell them about America's maritime heritage and who we are as a country.
It takes 150 cadets and sailors to operate this vessel. It is quite an operation. It's got 5 miles of lines to hoist these sails up, and it will be leading the charge into New York Harbor come the 4th of July weekend. And the Blue Angels will be flying along with them as well. They buzzed the mast yesterday while we were sailing in from Annapolis. Quite a sight for sure. Weather looks to be, well, we'll see. We got a week away. We got a week until we get to it, but it is warming up as we head towards the July 4th week. Happy birthday, America. It was quite a way to celebrate that, Vlad. And Baltimore, by the way, Vlad, as you know.
All right.
Baltimore is just spectacular.
It really is. And so are you, Marciano.
Yeah. Right? You look good.
Standing on the bow of that ship. Good. Aye, Captain.
Yes.
I'm king of the world.
Yeah, you look good.
You're not lying. Rob Marciano for us. Thank you very much.
In this morning's Money Watch, we're looking at the rising cost of owning a home. You probably know the price of buying one has surged, but the expenses don't just stop there. The median cost of a home renovation is $20,000. CBS Saturday Morning co-anchor and Money Watch correspondent Kelly O'Grady takes us through some money-saving tips.
Owning a home is part of the American dream, but with higher prices, it's grown increasingly out of reach. The median price of a home is at a record, over $400,000. And for many who already own, moving could mean trading to a higher mortgage rate. Adding to the price inflation, the war in Iran, weather, and tariffs all contributing to higher supply costs. Aluminum is up roughly 37% annually. Copper is up 25%, and steel is up 13%. Husband and wife Michael and Ellie Moreau's run Michael Roberts Construction and Ellie Moreau's Design.
How have you seen material prices change over the last few years?
Material prices have gone up just like everything else. Sometimes we will give a client an estimate of what we think it'll cost to finish their renovation. And if they drag their feet, we have to recalculate everything to keep them, you know, within their budget.
Are there reasons other than demand that you are seeing for why materials are going up?
Definitely. We're seeing freight surcharges, we're seeing tariff charges, and they're unpredictable. So when we get a quote from our supplier, there'll be a line on there that says your order will be subject to a tariff.
Consumers are adjusting to the changing economic landscape. Recently, Whirlpool, the company behind KitchenAid and Maytag, told investors fewer Americans are buying its appliances, due in part to the war with Iran. Even Home Depot, which beat earnings last quarter, says its customers are holding off on bigger projects. Mike and Ellie took me to their home to show me cost-saving tips.
Where are the places that people tend to overspend?
From a design perspective, I feel like people walk in, they see the size of their home. They're thinking like bigger is better. And so that's an overspend in my opinion.
Well, one of our goals is to not have spaces that you're not going to use.
For small changes that make a big difference, the couple says arched doorways and custom lighting built into the walls and ceilings can make homes feel higher end without busting your budget. But don't just focus on cosmetic changes. Maintenance on the roof, HVAC flooring, and climate proofing can save you costly repairs later.
What are some of those things that people just miss, they never think of, and then they regret once they've bought the home?
For me, it's window treatments. There's a reason for that. A, window treatments are very expensive. And B, how are you going to cover a huge window in your bathroom without now making it dark in there? So you can do each window for a couple $100. But then think about how many windows you have in your home.
And when it comes to materials,
whatever you can maintain, I think will last forever.
They say with proper maintenance, vinyl siding can last 30 years. Real wood siding could last 100 years. And while you can't touch up certain materials like quartz or porcelain, other materials like marble or granite can be refinished. Your next great house could be the one you're already in.
And some quick tips to keep in mind. Don't skip the home inspection. Okay, it costs about $343 on average, but it could save you thousands in repairs later. And for renovations, build in a cushion, permits, dumpster rentals, debris hauling, higher utility bills during work, temporary housing, and even a property tax reassessment after major work. That can all add up. Mm.
All good advice, as always. Kelly, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
It's time for stories that caught our eye. The lovely Adriana Diaz is doing the honors today. Good morning, Adriana.
Good morning, Gail. Good morning, everybody. So we begin with the latest in a trial of a man accused of setting the fire that exploded into the deadly Palisades wildfire in California. A federal jury has told a judge it cannot reach a unanimous verdict. Jonathan Rindernecht is accused of starting the initial fire last year. The disaster killed 12 people and destroyed 6,500 structures. Rindernecht's defense team says he did not start the fire and was simply a witness to it. The jury is expected back in court this morning. And the Supreme Court is siding with the company that makes the controversial weed killer Roundup. The ruling is expected to block thousands of lawsuits alleging the company failed to warn people that the product could cause cancer. It comes after a Missouri man sued Roundup owner Bayer, saying he developed cancer after decades of use. The court said that since the EPA had determined the weed killer safe, federal law does not require a warning label, and that supersedes any state requirements that say otherwise. Turning now to a stunning video of a house explosion, take a look at this. It happened in Washington State. Fire officials say the blast was caused by a massive stash of, you guessed it, fireworks. The explosion destroyed two homes and damaged a third. Three firefighters were injured, along with two residents. Luckily, though, guys, everyone is expected to recover. An investigation is underway into what started the fire that sparked the explosion. I wonder if they were stocking up for 4th of July. We'll see. All right.
Don't keep them in your home.
Yeah.
Don't keep them in
General
your home.
Rule
Definitely
of thumb.
Note to self. Don't yes. keep them in your home.
And finally, we have an update on the dog that went viral after being caught drooling over a hot dog. People were wondering, who is this poor, jealous pup in the corner? And now we have an answer. He has been identified as 6-year-old rescue named Jonah. So the Miami Marlins put out the call to find him after Jonah, with those puppy dog eyes, watched another dog eat a hot dog right in front of him.
Oh, poor Jonah.
And it all unfolded during the team's Bark at the Park event, where you could bring your puppies. But don't worry, Inside Edition made things right.
I think you deserve a hot dog, Jonah.
Oh, yeah, there he goes. You got it, buddy.
Yeah, I think he wants another one. That was quick.
He got his hot dog. So Jonah, through his human that you saw there, has accepted the Marlins' offer of a dream day at the ballpark.
Poor Jonah is just sitting there. He's like, hey,
why didn't they just
what about
share?
Me?
I don't think they saw him. Oh. But what dog just sits there and looks?
I know.
My dog Lava would have stolen that hot dog so fast.
Exactly right.
You don't even notice him in the beginning of the video. He's just kind of lurking in the background in the shadow.
Face.
And then you sort of focus
then he
in
blinks.
On him and you're like,
wait for the blink where he's just like, I want some.
Stone still.
Poor Jonah.
All right.
Well trained.
Adriana,
well trained is right.
Thank you as always, Adriana. We turn now to Britain, where King Charles is upending nearly two centuries of royal tradition. The King and Queen Camilla will not live in Buckingham Palace after its 10-year, multi-million dollar renovation is completed next year. The royals are also breaking another tradition. Raimi Innocencio is outside the palace. Raimi, good morning.
Hey, Matt. Yeah, good morning there. You're right. King Charles and Queen Camilla making a decision saying that they will not move into that little building right there in Buckingham Palace, of course, breaking with a tradition that's nearly 200 years old after this massive 10-year renovation is complete. That'll be next year. And then there is the king's tax bill. That's another break from history, revealing that he is one of the UK's top 100 taxpayers.
Buckingham Palace has been the gem of a backdrop in the crown of Britain's royal estates for nearly two centuries, but it will no longer be used as a home, say King Charles and Queen Camilla. The official reason, so visitors can enter year-round, not just the summer. As for tax reporting, the royals started paying income tax in 1992, but it's this year they revealed how much they actually paid. King Charles, nearly $17 million. His son, Prince William, about $10 million. From income drawn from their massive private estates attached to their titles. Income coming from rent, tourism, and commercial deals on farms, apartments, and castles worth billions of dollars. And from taxes, the public also contributes to royal operations. Last year, nearly $115 million. William's trip to Saudi Arabia this year cost nearly $200,000. The family logged nearly 200 helicopter journeys at a cost of nearly $1 million. Despite the costs, YouGov polling shows 64% of Britons still want to keep the monarchy. But not everyone agrees. Protesters turning out again this year, demanding it be abolished.
And one London brand consultancy here says that the monarchy contributes more than $2 billion to the British economy every single year. Some here would say that their contribution is actually priceless. The palace says next year's tax bill is already being calculated, and that will be revealed to the public, too. Gail.
All right. Raimi Innocencio, we thank you.
Okay. This morning, we are remembering a powerhouse voice of a generation. David Clayton Thomas, the singer of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, died peacefully in a Toronto hospital on Wednesday. Many might not realize that these guys seem destined to be the next Beatles before getting lost behind the Iron Curtain.
What goes up must come down.
With their huge hit, Spinning Wheel, Blood, Sweat, and Tears was one of the biggest bands of the late 60s. In 1969, they headlined Woodstock. The next year, David Clayton Thomas was handed an Album of the Year Grammy by Louis Armstrong after besting the Beatles' last ever recorded album in that category.
I can't quit her alone. She got a hand on me, she got a hold of my soul.
And what many say shot down their rising star was the Cold War. The band's bizarre series of shows in then-Soviet cities, arranged by the U.S. State Department, allegedly through blackmail, proved extremely controversial.
I think we were naive. I don't think we realized how it would bounce up and bite us.
As a Canadian, Clayton Thomas was threatened with deportation.
I'm not scared of dying, and I don't really care.
Another of Clayton Thomas's biggest hits was And When I Die, an upbeat and loving ode to life's only real certainty.
And when I die, when I'm gone, there'll be one child born in this world to carry on, to carry on.
David Clayton Thomas was 84 years old.
I haven't heard his voice in years, but isn't it amazing how it all comes back to you when you hear it?
It really does. And of course, my favorite Blood, Sweat, and Tears song is You've Made Me So Very Happy.
I'm so glad you came into my life. He has such a distinct
voice. That's really impressive.
Yeah.
We're taking the show on the road, people.
Matt, move on.
Yeah,
move on.
No, I love it. You got Jalen Brunson's mom.
Okay, we'll go. Coming up, Nick star, Jalen Brunson's mom. She's good. Sandra talks about raising a champion. First on CBS Morning. There it is.
They're playing it.
First on CBS Morning, she shares her philosophy on parenting. I do love this song. A shocking moment on the court is stirring up major controversy in the WNBA. Here's a look. Alyssa Thomas, she's of the Phoenix Mercury, puts her fist on Caitlin Clark's throat during a game against the Indiana Fever. Now, Thomas was later suspended for a reckless flagrant foul, but at the time, no foul was called on this. Clark's coach says it's part of a pattern. Chanel Call has more.
Clark, defended by Hell, lost her footing.
On Thursday, the WNBA said it suspended Phoenix Mercury star Alyssa Thomas for one game.
I mean, Caitlin to the ground and, ooh.
A day after she used her fist to press down on Indiana Fever star Caitlin Clark's throat during a game. That incident came just 2 days after another physical matchup between the Fever and Mercury, which featured several technical fouls and an ejection.
And I just say again, absolutely unacceptable.
In a fiery press conference Wednesday, Fever head coach Stephanie White said the refereeing was disrespectful.
Clark with space, time.
She pointed to another play that happened in the second quarter when Clark was fouled while shooting a three. White said that incident should have been upgraded to a flagrant. Clark later exited the game with back issues.
We have a WNBA superstar who had two cheap shots right there. The one thing that we keep asking for is consistency. She is not called the same way everybody else is called.
She's probably as animated as I've ever seen a Fever coach.
James Boyd is a staff writer for The Athletic who's covered the Fever for 5 years. During that time, Clark has dealt with several instances of heavy contact going back to her rookie season.
You just cannot let it cross that line to the point where you're no longer playing basketball. It's no longer, just a little, competitive spirit. It's a dangerous play.
In a statement, the WNBA said Thomas would serve her suspension during tomorrow's game when the Mercury visits Toronto. The Indiana Fever say they appreciate the league's review of the incident, adding that player safety should be paramount. Guys?
All right, Chanel, thank you very much. It looked to me to be very flagrant. You can't do that.
Certainly the fist in the throat
can't
is not
that.
A great look.
And no, not
you can tell that she was using it to sort of lift herself off of it.
Yeah.
Now, I was wondering, did anything happen between the two of them? Is there history? But when you look at that video, it's very tough to watch.
Slid it down her arm into her neck.
But these are hyper-competitive people in a sport that we don't consider a contact sport, but kind of is.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Thank you, Chanel. Appreciate it.
The name of the book, it's called Regime Change, Inside the Imperial Presidency of Donald Trump. We make it very easy for you to buy this book. It's flying off the shelves. Now it's your turn. Scan the QR code on your screen. You can buy it right now. The book includes revelations we've never heard before from conversations with the president himself and other key officials at every level in his administration. It's based on more than 1,000 interviews over a long period of time. New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan are the authors, and we're happy to say that they are here live and in color in the studio. So glad to have you guys here. Most of us, if you follow the news the way we do, we knew a lot of the stories, but we didn't know a lot of the details. And there was many lines stood out to me, but I just have to start with this. His complete absence of shame, historically unusual among American presidents, has become a political superpower. In his second term, President Trump has bent and even broken institutions. It makes me think about the title Regime Change, because for most people, when you think regime change, you think other countries. Here, you're talking about regime change in our own country. Mm-hmm. And I think we should start with the difference between Trump presidency number one and Trump administration number two.
Sure. So this administration, again, thank you for having us. This administration is so unrecognizable to Trump's first one. And it became really clear to us as we were conceiving of this book, reporting for it. This was months, years of reporting. We had to leave so much on the cutting room floor that we were covering not the transfer of power from a Democrat to a Republican or Democrat to a Democrat. This is a fundamentally different conception of the U.S. presidency. It is changing how countries around the world, leaders around the world, how people in the U.S. look at their president. And we're not used to covering regime change, as you say, here. But that is what we were doing. And in fact, this title was conceived of prior to the Maduro operation in Venezuela.
It was before. Yeah.
And it's really about the way he's using executive power. We haven't seen anything like this in our lifetime in terms of the unilateral expression of executive power at a time where, you know, it's pretty hard to think of a precedent for a U.S. president having the command that Trump has had over his own party in Congress that he had in 2025. There really isn't a precedent. I mean, he basically got them to do whatever he wanted. And Congress wasn't even consulted when he went to war with Iran. I mean, remember when George W. Bush took America to war in Iraq and Afghanistan? Look, as flawed as the decision-making process was, there was a process where it got approved by Congress, the branch of government that under the Constitution...
Congress wasn't consulted about Maduro either.
He didn't even talk to... So again, Trump is just acting. He is acting, and the system is trying to catch up to him. That's really the way it's working.
Well, So with that in mind, the fact that the president is pushing against norms that have been tradition and law in this country since its founding, what struck me is how he built his cabinet, the people that are around him, that are advising him. Maggie, on page 13, you write about Trump's decision to tap John Ratcliffe as CIA director. That section says, "This guy looks like Cary Grant," Trump added. "He's straight out of central casting. If you're going to cast a guy to play CIA director, that's who you'd pick." There seemed to be only two qualifications at that moment. Either how you looked or if you were loyal to Trump. Not are you able to protect the American people? Are you able to grow the economy or further our national interests?
Or qualifications.
Or if I push against the norms or the law, you're there to stop me or act as somebody who, not to stop, you can't, you don't want to stop the president, but you're there to advise me against it.
Yeah, I mean, loyalty was a premier characteristic that he was seeking. And loyalty, and we write about this, has a bit of a fungible definition. But what became, for him anyway, what became the real litmus test was January 6th, where you were on January 6th and where you were on January 7th. If on January 7th, in Trump's mind, in any way, you were separated from him, he did not want you around. And we described several anecdotes that lead to that, including one about Robert O'Brien, who had been incredibly loyal to him as his final national security advisor in term one. He had some memory of O'Brien being not fully on board with him. It was all that he had done was praise Mike Pence on January 6th. And Trump sees his face, and we take you inside the tea room at Mar-a-Lago for these meetings during the transition. And Trump just has like a visceral reaction and says, get him off on the screen. He doesn't want him there. You know, he was shaking in his boots on January 7th. The central casting aspect is a big one. Part of that is Pete Hegseth, how you now have him as the Secretary of Defense slash War. He liked that Hegseth was good on TV. He liked that Hegseth defended, quote unquote, warriors. When it came to someone like Tulsi Gabbard, who was the Director of National Intelligence, it was, let's give it to her. What harm could she really do?
One of the things, Jonathan, that this book does extraordinarily well is put us, the reader, in the room. And there's that meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the Situation Room with President Trump, looking at this presentation that he is giving them
with
a very small group of people.
Yeah.
And the assessment that you write in the book afterwards, and I think it was Raising General Kane or Ratcliffe, that this was a farcical view of what would happen in the actual war if it happened. And it was bull. So who's playing whom here? Is it Netanyahu playing Trump or Trump playing Netanyahu?
Our reporting, there's a sort of narrative out there that Netanyahu is puppeteering Trump. Our reporting doesn't support that at all. Trump was actually the most hawkish member of his team when it came to Iran. And if you look at his history, even though he has talked about no more new wars, etc., he's always been pretty hawkish on Iran. You know, going back many years, he pulled out of the Iran deal in term one. He assassinated Soleimani. But this was a fascinating meeting with Netanyahu. I mean, he comes into the Situation Room and he gives a presentation on how the war could go. And there's a video montage of different new leaders that might take over Iran. And what you're referring to is overnight, the CIA did a very quick analysis on this presentation, and they concluded that these regime change scenarios were not going to bear out. Trump went ahead with it anyway. He had a gut instinct that this was going to be a fast war.
And almost everything that Netanyahu prophesied in that presentation did not happen when the war unfolded.
Correct. That's right. And it is still ongoing, and they're trying to get out of it.
You also write about it's difficult for people close to him to tell him the truth. No one likes to bring him bad news. Mm-hmm. But to be fair, isn't that the case with most presidents? What makes this different? Most presidents, their people don't like to give them bad news. How is it different in the Trump administration compared to other administrations?
It's a fair question because, you know, certainly Joe Biden did not like hearing bad news. And that was a key aspect of that presidency. Donald Trump didn't like hearing bad news in term one. But he did have more inputs. Joe Biden also had other inputs. Joe Biden would watch mainstream news. He would take briefings from his government. Again, he did not like hearing things weren't going well. Trump is in an information bubble that is unlike anything that I can remember. Yeah, I mean, the inputs that are reaching him are so small. This is a government, and we really tried to show this in this book, where decisions are being made by a group of about a half a dozen people. You point to what you were asking about in terms of the war. The Energy Secretary and the Treasury Secretary, the two people would have to manage the after effects and economic impacts of a global energy crisis caused by this war, were not part of these meetings initially because they were concerned about leaks.
I didn't catch the part. Who's giving you all this information?
Jonathan? Neil wants to know your sources.
Well, that's an interesting question.
I am fascinated by someone in his inner circle is
talking. Which would have spoken to these two reporters and the motivation behind that, specifically as it relates to one of the most vivid accounts in the book, the Epstein files, which has to do with the Epstein files, where you make clear that the president wants it all to go away. The people in the room with him say it's not going to be easy. Take us there.
Well, this was pretty extraordinary series of meetings that happened last summer. And the setting itself was extraordinary. I mean, the White House Situation Room is the National Security Command Center of the United States government. It's where Lyndon Johnson monitored the Vietnam War. It's where Barack Obama monitored the raid, which ended in the killing of Osama bin Laden. Over the summer of last year, they essentially turned the Situation Room into an Epstein crisis response center. And you had the most senior officials in the US government gathering in that room to figure out essentially a PR strategy to deal with the Epstein crisis. One of the problems they had was they had built this website that they were going to release, a Justice Department public-facing website. And they were searching around in it for Trump, and they were finding a lot of stuff on Trump. And some of it was, you know, embarrassing. So they had to make decisions about what to disclose and what not to disclose. But that really was a political crisis that has had long-term effects, way beyond what his team expected. We got some confidential memos from his pollster, and it's still having political effects even this year.
Wow. It'll be interesting to see how this all turns out. You said history is still writing
being written,
story.
And you are writing that first draft of history. Maggie Haberman, Jonathan Swan, thank you very much. Book's incredible. We appreciate you coming on. Regime Change is on sale right now. Scan the QR code on your screen to get your copy.
What are you most proud of when it comes to this guy?
Just the way he carries himself. You know,
thanks, Mom.
Oh, right away, big bang.
That's 100% my mother.
100% my mother. I like it. That was NBA superstar Jalen Brunson. After helping lead the New York Knicks to their first NBA championship title in more than 50 years, we're still on a high from that in New York City. This morning, first on CBS Mornings, and we love when that happens. I'm going to say it again. First on CBS Mornings, we're hearing from Jalen's mom fresh off of that win. Her name is Sandra Brunson. She is co-founder of the Second Round Foundation. She started this nonprofit with Jalen to help young people. So Sandra sat down with our chief medical correspondent, that would be Dr. John LaPook, there they are, in Colorado, to discuss the foundation and her approach to parenting. And Dr. LaPook brought along a reminder of her own past.
Volleyball. Wow.
Jalen's not the only athlete.
Knicks fans, this is not a dream.
Long before her son, Jalen Brunson, led the Knicks to an NBA championship. With her husband, Rick, on the coaching staff, Sandra Brunson was a Division I volleyball player at Temple University.
This ball taught me a lot about myself.
What did it teach you?
It really opened my eyes to possibilities.
Those possibilities now include the Second Round Foundation, the nonprofit Sandra co-founded in 2022 with her son, Jalen. The mission? To empower young people by providing educational opportunities, access to sports, healthy nutrition, and other critical resources.
Why is it called the Second Round Foundation?
The Second Round Foundation was born out of Jalen's journey. He was the 33rd pick in the NBA draft. And for some people who don't know, the 33rd pick is in the second round. I wanted him to understand that just because he wasn't viewed as a top 10 pick in the NBA didn't mean that he couldn't succeed.
Fresh off the Knicks' NBA championship run, Sandra Brunson took the stage at Aspen Ideas Health, a Colorado conference exploring the future of medicine, wellness, and science.
Through sport, they are actually building what the foundation of what is helping them through life.
She was there along with football star Russell Wilson to game out ways to improve youth mental health, a cause she believes is essential to helping young people thrive.
The foundation began in 2022.
Yes.
What do you want people to know about it?
The fastest way that we can have an impact is to go to schools where children need resources and families need resources. We're small and we're growing and it's all volunteers. We move slowly. Mm-hmm.
Small steps.
Small steps because they're very methodical.
Slow and methodical. That reminds me of somebody's style of playing.
Slow right? and methodical.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's who he is. He's slow and methodical.
That's who he is, but it's also the metaphor for what you're doing in a way.
Yes.
Sandra's slow and steady approach to her foundation mirrors her philosophy on parenting Jalen and his younger sister, Erica. Hard work, no shortcuts, and keeping perspective.
Tell me about Notes on the Refrigerator.
I would say it started about his sophomore year in high school. So I started giving him like devotionals or little notes, tape it to the mirror in the bathroom, tape it in the fridge. I would put it in his lunch bag.
Sandra started another tradition to help give Jalen perspective, texting him before each game.
To give him some words of encouragement, to put what he's doing in perspective, you know, like it's a big game, it's this, but it's not the end of the world. Basketball.
Even though it is technically just a basketball game, that doesn't mean Sandra Brunson isn't hanging on every play.
I saw this on Instagram. Describe that picture. When was that taken?
Game four. There's so much to this picture. You just want your child to be happy and to fulfill their goals. This is just a mom just trying to will her son and his teammates to victory.
So let's take it to a good place, okay?
So please.
Brunson gets it, fires up a three. Shot no good, the tip, it's gone!
One thing I told him in years past is that as a leader, he has to understand that everyone has a job to do. And every one of his teammates has to feel comfortable in their role and believe in their role, no matter what it is. And that's his role as a leader. And I think that he has learned over the years, it's not what happens, it's how you respond.
Sandra told me the foundation's looking for partners to help them grow. They have a big golf fundraiser coming up in Rye, New York on August 10th. And for more information, you can go to secondroundfoundation.org. She is so impressive. And,
terrific. Yes.
I was at game four, right?
Yeah.
Remember the tip? It was incredible. But she and I were talking about what really impressed both of us is you remember that Josh Hart missed an open layup with about 2 minutes left. And the next play, Wemby gets fouled. He's on the floor. And three Knicks come over, Brunson, Cat, and Alvarado, and you can see how upset Josh is, but they just pick him up, and that a fourth Knick that could have been there is Sandra Brunson, because that's all her, just carry on, be
Something
resilient.
Tells me a lot of people are going to want to go to that golf tournament.
Yeah.
She's doing great work. She's
picking
terrific.
Up the whole team and the family. Okay, Dr. John LaPook, thank you.
The excitement is growing for this weekend's BET Awards. It's in Los Angeles. Comedian and entertainer Drewski is taking the stage as host. Listen to this. He's the youngest person ever in that role. The awards celebrate the biggest name in entertainment, sports, and music. So Nate has been in L.A. for the last couple of days. He's got a preview. Nate, number one, I love seeing you and Drewski together because I know he is ready. And the two of you, we were all talking about what you had on, Nate. Hanging out with Drewski.
Well, you know, I had to show up and show out while I'm in L.A. hanging out with Drewski. And that's right. He told me that he's not holding back on the jokes, even though some of his friends are the celebs that will be sitting in the crowd that he's roasting. And as you mentioned, at 31, he is the youngest host of the award show. And he took me behind the scenes of culture's biggest night.
I ain't playing with y'all. I deserve it just like everybody else.
That's a fact.
I'm a legend in the making. When I said I'm a star, I said I'm a beat it.
Okay, all right, save a little bit.
That's what I eat.
Save a little bit.
That's what I
eat. Save a little bit for the show.
Yeah, chill. Let's talk over here.
Yeah, let's talk over here. Let's talk over here.
The stage is set, and host Drewski is ready for the culture's biggest night on Sunday.
This Cardi B seat right here.
Cardi B gonna be right here.
Let me see how this feels, man.
How that feel? That's a good spot?
We need to get Cardi B more in the front over there. I don't want her to sit over here. Let's get Cardi B over there.
These seats at the Peacock Theater in Los Angeles will be filled with celebrities in entertainment, music, and sports.
Do you think about what you're going to say to the celebrities before they are seated, or do you look at where they are seated and
you're like,
okay,
you got to see it in real time. Yeah, you got to see it in real time because I told everybody it's going to be black suit and tie. Ain't nobody getting roses until I get a chance to see them.
What are y'all doing here?
I'm hosting the BET Awards.
Drewski promises to deliver an entertaining show, bringing his familiar comedy to the 2026 BET Awards.
Where I'm from, they call that Nala Palmer.
The comedian has built a massive following with his viral comedy sketches on social media. His jokes have gone far beyond that, and he is now a bona fide entertainer.
And how's it feel to be that main attraction, man, on a stage like this? A show that you've been watching since you were younger.
For sure, man. I think it is definitely a moment, and I know it's time. I've worked so hard, like for the last 8-9 years, I've been grinding to get a chance to be in this moment. And now that I'm here, it feels right, you know?
He joins a long line of comedians who have hosted the show, including Kevin Hart, Anthony Anderson, and its first hosts, Cedric the Entertainer and Steve Harvey.
My whole family used to gather around the TV and look at these moments of all the comedic legends before me, like the kings of comedy, Kevin Hart.
Sitting there like, oh.
And yeah, it's like, it's, yeah. And the moments too, it's like, it's surreal, you know what I mean?
As far as the awards, Cardi B leads the nominations with 6.
Roman numeral 7, beige, wrap it like it's hot.
Followed by Kendrick Lamar and Mariah the Scientist, each earning 5 nods. Trailblazers are also being recognized. Oscar nominee Teyana Taylor is being honored as the Icon of the Year.
Let me tell you that everything is everything.
Everything is everything.
And Lauryn Hill is getting the inaugural Living Legend Icon Award. Superstars Jill Scott, Common, and Duran Bernard are just some of the artists bringing the heat on stage performing.
Donna, Lynn, Pat, Lori, Shelly, Aaliyah, Rose, Brian, Darren, and Ulysses, thank you for holding down the fort.
For the past 25 years, the BET Awards have been creating moments in the culture.
When it comes to the BET Awards, what's your favorite moment?
One favorite moment that I have, I can't lie, the Michael Jackson moment where he came and put the veil on top of James Brown.
The robe.
Yeah, the robe on top of James Brown. That was,
yeah, that was different. That was just icon meeting icon.
Yes.
Culture is a bunch of different buckets.
Connie Orlando is BET's executive vice president.
I grew up on BET. I've seen the evolution of this award show. How special is it that the fan base, the audience, spans decades?
Right. I mean, I think that's what it's supposed to do, right? So you said a very important word, evolution. So 10 years ago, we didn't know that this was what it would look like today. Yeah. And 10 years from now, like, the culture will keep evolving and we'll keep showing up to kind of meet that need and what people want.
Drewski is their guide to meet the moment.
Black excellence.
Mm-hmm. Black excellence right there. Mm-hmm.
And he wants the stars hitting the red carpet to come correct. He definitely will be.
Hey. I don't want to brag and boast on here. You know that I'm not that type of guy. I'll be on the red carpet in Louis Vuitton.
And two more things that I am compelled to mention that he said to me is that he spoke this into existence. In 2019, he wrote down, "I will host the BET Awards," which I thought was awesome. And then he mentioned Kevin Hart, not just as a former host. He said that quite literally, he would not be in this position if it wasn't for Kevin Hart opening the door. So he gave Kevin Hart his flowers.
Nate, he seems so ready for this moment. I just think he's going to make it fun. He's so confident. He goes, "I'm a legend in the making." Not too many people can say that. You look like you had a great time with him.
Yeah,
I did. He is so funny, so natural. Like you said, Gil, he's been working on this, going from social media star to now hosting one of the biggest award shows there is.
Yep. Bravo, bravo.
You know, Rose is funny and natural. That's Nate Burleson right
there.
That
is true.
Oh, man.
Good. Stop it,
you can watch the BET Awards this Sunday at 8. p.m. Eastern and Pacific on BET, which is part of our parent company. You know that. Watching CBS Mornings.